This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Ghosts of the Shadow Market, Book 2, Cast Long Shadows, by Cassandra Clare and Sarah Reese Brennan, read by Jonathan Bailey.
Old sins cast long shadows. English proverb. London, 1901. The railway viaduct passed only a hair's breadth away from the Church of St. Saviour. There had been discussion among the mundanes about the possibility of demolishing the church to make way for the railroad, but it had met with unexpectedly fierce opposition. Instead, the railway took a slightly more circuitous route, and the spire of the church still remained a silver dagger against the night sky. Beneath the arches, crosses, and rattling rails, a mundane market was held by day, the largest association of grocers in the city. By night, the market belonged to the downworld. Vampires and werewolves, warlocks and the fae met under the stars and under glamour that human eyes could not pierce. They had their magic stalls set up in the same pattern as the human stalls, under the bridges and through tiny streets. But the shadow market stalls did not hold apples or turnips. Under the dark arches, the stalls shone, laden with bells and ribbons, gaudy with colour. Snake green, fever red, and the startling orange of flames. Brother Zachariah smelt incense burning and heard the songs of werewolves for the distant beauty of the moon, and fairies calling for children to come away, come away. It was the first shadow market of the new year by English standards, though it was still the old year in China. Brother Zachariah had left Shanghai when he was a child, and London when he was 17, to go to the Silent City, where there was no acknowledgement of time passing save that the ashes of more warriors were laid down. Still, he remembered the celebrations of the new year in his human life, from eggnog and fortune-telling in London to the setting off of fireworks and nibbling of moon dumplings in Shanghai. Now, snow was falling on London. The air was crisp and cold as a fresh apple and felt good against his face. The voices of his brothers were a low hum in his head, affording Brother Zachariah a little distance. Zachariah was here on a mission, but he took a brief time to be glad he was in London, in the shadow market, to breathe air clear of the dust of the departed. It felt something like freedom, like being young again. He rejoiced, but that did not mean the people of the shadow market rejoiced with him. He observed many downworlders and even mundanes with the sight, casting him looks that were the opposite of welcoming. As he moved, a dark murmur threaded through the hum of conversation all around him. The denizens of the downworld considered this market time as space snatched away from angels. They clearly did not relish his presence among them. Brother Zachariah was one of the silent brothers, a voiceless fraternity that lived long amid old bones, sworn to seclusion with hearts dedicated to the dust of their city and their dead. Nobody could be expected to embrace a silent brother, and these people would not be likely to take pleasure in the appearance of any shadow hunter at all. Even as he doubted, he saw a stranger sight than any he had expected in the market. There was a shadow hunter boy dancing a can-can with three fairies. He was Charlotte and Henry Fairchild's younger son, Matthew Fairchild. His head was thrown back, his fair hair bright by firelight, and he was laughing. Brother Zachariah had an instant to wonder if Matthew was spellbound before Matthew caught sight of him and bounded forward, leaving the fairies behind him looking discomforted. The fair folk were not accustomed to having mortals skip out on their dances. Matthew did not appear to notice. He ran up to Brother Zachariah, threw an exuberant arm about his neck, and ducked his head under the hood of the silent brother to give him a kiss on the cheek. "Uncle Jem!" Matthew exclaimed joyfully. "What are you doing here?" Idris, 1899. Matthew Fairchild hardly ever lost his temper. When he did, he tried to make the occasion memorable. The last time had been 2 years ago, during Matthew's short-lived stint at Shadow Hunter Academy, a school intended to mass-produce perfect demon-fighting boars. It began with half the school crowded on a tower top, watching the parents arrive after an incident in the woods with a demon. Matthew's usual good humour had already been sorely tried. His best friend James was being blamed for the incident, simply because James happened to have a tiny, insignificant amount of demon blood and the, Matthew thought prodigiously lucky, ability to transform into a shadow. James was being expelled. The actual people to blame, unmitigated wart, Alistair Carstairs and his rotten friends, were not being expelled. Life in general, and the Academy in particular, was a positive parade of injustice. Matthew had not even had the chance to ask James if he wanted to be Parapatai yet. He had been planning to ask him to be sworn warrior partners in a very elaborate and stylish fashion, so Jamie would be too impressed to decline. Mr. Herondale, James's father, was among the first of the parents to arrive. They saw him stride in the doors with his black hair turbulent from wind and rage. Mr. Herondale undeniably had an air. The few girls permitted to come to the academy were casting James speculative glances. James shuffled about the place with his head in a book and had an unfortunate haircut and an unassuming demeanour, but he bore a very marked resemblance to his father. James, angel bless his oblivious soul, failed to notice anyone's attention. He slunk away to be expelled, sunk in despair. "Gosh," said Eustace Larkspear, "it would be something to have a father like that." "I heard he was mad," said Alistair and let out a bark of laughter. "You have to be mad to marry a creature with infernal blood and have children who are..."
"Don't," said little Thomas quietly.
To everyone's surprise, Alistair rolled his eyes and desisted. Matthew wanted to be the one to have made Alistair stop, but Thomas had already done it, and Matthew could not think of any way to stop Alistair permanently short of challenging him to a duel. He was not even sure that would work. Alistair was not a coward, and would probably accept the challenge and then talk twice as much. Besides which, getting into fights was not precisely Matthew's style. He could fight, but he did not think violence solved many problems. Aside from the problem of demons laying waste to the world, that was. Matthew left the tower top abruptly and wandered the halls of the academy in a foul mood. Despite his commitment to dark brooding, he knew he was duty-bound not to lose track of Christopher and Thomas Lightwood for long. When he was 6, Matthew's older brother, Charles Buford, and his mamma had left the house for a meeting at the London Institute. Charlotte Fairchild was the consul, the most important person of all the Shadow Hunters, and Charles had always been interested in her work instead of resenting the bothersome Nephilim for taking up her time. As they prepared to go, Matthew had stood in the hall crying and refusing to let go of his mother's dress. Mamma had knelt down and asked that Matthew please take care of Papa for her while she and Charles were gone. Matthew took this responsibility seriously. Papa was a genius, and what most people considered an invalid because he could not walk. Unless he was carefully watched, he would forget to eat in the excitement of invention. Papa could not get on without Matthew, which was why it was absurd that Matthew had been sent to the academy in the first place. Matthew liked to take care of people, and he was good at it. When they were 8, Christopher Lightwood had been discovered in Papa's laboratory performing what Papa described as a very intriguing experiment. Matthew had noticed that there was now a wall missing in the laboratory, and he took Christopher under his wing. Christopher and Thomas were real cousins, their father's brothers. Matthew was not a real cousin. He only called Christopher's and Thomas's parents Aunt Cecily and Uncle Gabriel, and Aunt Sophie and Uncle Gideon respectively out of courtesy. Their parents were only friends. Mama had no close family, and Papa's family did not approve of Mama being consul. James was Christopher's blood cousin. Aunt Cecily was Mr. Herondale's sister. Mr. Herondale ran the London Institute, and the Herondales tended to keep to themselves. Unkind people said it was because they were snobbish, or thought themselves superior, but Charlotte said those people were ignorant. She told Matthew the Herondales tended to keep to themselves, as they had experienced unkindness due to Mrs. Herondale being a warlock. Still, when you ran an institute, you couldn't be completely invisible. Matthew had seen James at various parties before and tried to acquire him as a friend, only Matthew was impeded because he felt he should contribute to parties being a success, and James tended to be in a corner reading. It was usually a simple matter for Matthew to make friends, but he did not see the point unless it was a challenge. Friends who were easy to get might be easy to lose, and Matthew wanted to keep people. It had been rather shattering when James seemed to actively dislike Matthew, but Matthew had won him over. He still wasn't entirely sure how, which made him uneasy, but James had recently referred to himself, Matthew, Christopher and Thomas as the Three Musketeers and D'Artagnan from a book he liked. Everything had been going splendidly, aside from missing Papa, but now James was expelled and everything was ruined. Still, Matthew could not forget his responsibilities. Christopher had a tempestuous relationship with science, and Professor Fell had commanded Matthew not to let Christopher come into contact with any flammable materials after last time. Thomas was so quiet and small, they were always losing him, rather like a human marble, and if left to his own devices, would inevitably roll towards Alistair Carstairs. This was a hideous situation with only one bright side. It was a simple matter to locate Thomas when he was lost. Matthew only had to follow the sound of Alistair's irritating voice. Unfortunately, this meant being forced to behold Alistair's irritating face. He found Alistair soon enough, gazing out of the window, with Thomas shyly standing at his elbow. Thomas's hero worship was inexplicable. The only things Matthew could find to like about Alistair were his extraordinarily expressive eyebrows, and eyebrows did not make the man.
"Are you very sad, Alistair?"
Matthew heard Thomas ask as he approached, bent on retrieval. "Stop bothering me, Pipsqueak," said Alistair, though his voice was tolerant. Even he could not strongly object to being adored. "You heard the low, sneaky serpent," said Matthew. "Come away, Tom." "Ah, Mother Hen Fairchild," sneered Alistair. "What a lovely wife you will make for somebody one of these fine days." Matthew was outraged to see Thomas's tiny smile, though Thomas quickly concealed it out of respect for Matthew's feelings. Thomas was meek and much afflicted by sisters. He seemed to think Alistair being rude to everyone was daring. "I wish I could say the same for you," said Matthew. "Has no kind soul thought to inform you that your hairstyle is, to use the gentlest words available to me, ill-advised? A friend? Your papa? Does nobody care enough to prevent you from making a spectacle of yourself? Or are you simply too busy perpetrating acts of evil upon the innocent to bother about your unfortunate appearance?"
"Matthew," said Thomas, "his friend died."
Matthew strongly desired to point out that Alistair and his friends had been the ones to unleash a demon upon James, and their nasty prank going wrong was no more than their just deserts. He could see, however, that this would distress Thomas extremely. "Oh, very well, let us go," he said, "though I cannot help but wonder whose idea their nasty little trick was." "Wait a moment, Fairchild," snapped Alistair. "You can go ahead, Lightwood." Thomas looked deeply worried as he went, but Matthew could see he was loath to disobey his idol. When Thomas's worried hazel eyes flicked to Matthew, Matthew nodded, and Thomas reluctantly departed. When he was gone, Matthew and Alistair squared off. Matthew understood that Alistair had sent Thomas away for a purpose. He bit his lip, resigned to a scuffle. Instead, Alistair said, "Who are you to play the moralist, talking about tricks and papas considering the circumstances of your birth?" Matthew frowned. "What on earth are you drivelling about, Carstairs? Everyone talks about your mama and her unwomanly pursuits," said awful, unthinkable worm Alistair Carstairs. Matthew scoffed, but Alistair raised his voice, persisting. "A woman cannot be a good consul. Nevertheless, your mother can continue her career, of course, since she has such strong support from the powerful Lightwoods." "Certainly our families are friends," said Matthew. "Are you unfamiliar with the concept of friendship, Carstairs? How tragic for you, though understandable on the part of everyone else in the universe." Alistair raised his eyebrows. "Oh, great friends, no doubt. Your mama must require friends, since your papa is unable to play a man's part."
"I beg your pardon," said Matthew.
"Odd that you were born so long after your papa's terrible accident," Alistair said, all but twirling an imaginary moustache. "Strange that your papa's family will have nothing to do with you, to the extent of demanding that your mother renounce her married name. Remarkable that you bear no resemblance to your papa, and your colouring is so like Gideon Lightwood's." Gideon Lightwood was Thomas's papa. No wonder Alistair had sent Thomas away before making a ridiculous accusation like that. It was absurd. Perhaps it was true that Matthew had fair hair, while his mama's was brown, and his father's and Charles Buford's was red. Matthew's mama was tiny, but Cook said she thought Matthew would be taller than Charles Buford. Uncle Gideon was often with Mama. Matthew knew he had spoken for her while she was at odds with the Clave. Mama had once called him her good and faithful friend. Matthew had never thought much about it before. His mama said his papa had such a dear, friendly, freckled face. Matthew had always wished he looked like him. But he didn't. Matthew said, his voice strange in his own ears, "I do not understand what you mean."
"Henry Branwell is not your father," spat Alistair. "You are Gideon Lightwood's bastard. Everybody knows it but you."
In a white and blinding rage, Matthew struck him in the face. Then he went to find Christopher, cleared the area, and gave him matches. A short but eventful time passed before Matthew left school, never to return. In that interval, a wing of the academy blew up. Matthew realized it had been a rather shocking thing to do, but while he was deranged, he also demanded James be his parabatai, and by some miracle, James agreed. Matthew and his papa arranged to spend more time at the Fairchilds' London home so that Matthew could be with both his papa and his parabatai. It had all, Matthew considered, worked out rather well. If only he could forget. The Shadow Market, London, 1901. Jem halted in the midst of the dancing flames and black iron arches of the London market, startled by the appearance of a familiar face in an unexpected context, and even more so by the warmth of Matthew's greeting. He knew Charlotte's son, of course. Her other boy, Charles, was always very cool and distant when he encountered Brother Zachariah on official business. Brother Zachariah knew that the Silent Brothers were meant to be detached from the world. His uncle Elias's son, Alistair, had made that very clear when Brother Zachariah reached out to him. "This is how it should be," said his brothers in his mind. He could not always tell one of their voices from the others. They were a quiet chorus, a silent, ever-present song. Jem would not have held it against Matthew if he felt the same way as many others, but he didn't seem to. His bright, delicate face showed dismay all too clearly. "Am I being too familiar?" he asked anxiously. "I only suppose since I was James Parabatai, and that is what he calls you, I might do so as well."
"Of course you may," said Brother Zachariah.
James did, and James's sister Lucy, and Alistair's sister Cordelia, had taken to doing so as well. Zachariah considered that they were the three sweetest children in the world. He knew he might be a little partial, but faith created truth. Matthew glowed. Zachariah was reminded of Matthew's mother, and the kindness that had taken in three orphans when she was hardly more than a child herself. "They all talk about you all the time in the London Institute," Matthew confided. "James and Lucy and Uncle Will and Aunt Tessa too. I feel as if I know you a great deal better than I actually do. So I beg pardon if I trespass on your kindness."
"There can be no trespass when you are always welcome," said Jem.
Matthew's smile spread. It was an extraordinarily engaging expression. His warmth was closer to the surface than Charlotte's, Jem thought. He had never been taught to close himself off, to do anything but delight and trust in the world. "I would like to hear all about your and Uncle Will's and Aunt Tessa's adventures from your point of view. You must have had a very exciting time. Nothing exciting ever happens to us. The way everyone talks about it, one might think you'd had a dramatic star-crossed passion with Aunt Tessa before you became a Silent Brother." Matthew stopped himself. "Sorry. My tongue ran away with me. Oh, I'm heedless and excited to talk to you properly. I'm sure it is strange to think of your past life. I hope I did not upset or offend you. I cry peace."
"Peace," echoed Brother Zachariah, amused.
"I am certain you could have had a torrid affair with any person you wanted, of course," said Matthew. "Anyone can see that. Oh, Lord, that was a heedless thing to say too, wasn't it?"
"It is very kind of you to say so," said Brother Zachariah. "Is it not a fine night?"
"I can see you are a very tactful fellow," said Matthew, and clapped Brother Zachariah on the back. They wandered through the stalls of the Shadow Market. Brother Zachariah was searching for one warlock in particular, who had agreed to help him.
"Does Uncle Will know you're in London?" asked Matthew.
"Are you going to see him? If Uncle Will finds out you're in London and did not come to call, and I knew about it, that will be curtains for me. Young life cut off in his prime. A bright flower of manhood withered untimely. You might think of me and my doom, Uncle Jem, you really might."
"Might I?" asked Brother Zachariah.
It was fairly obvious what Matthew was angling to know.
It would also be very kind of you if you refrained from mentioning that you saw me at the shadow market, Matthew wheedled, with his engaging smile and distinct air of apprehension.
Silent brothers are terrible gossips, as a rule, said Brother Zachariah. For you, though, Matthew, I will make an exception.
Thanks, Uncle Jem. Matthew linked his arm with Jem's. I can see we're going to be great friends. It must be a horrible contrast for the market to behold, Jem thought, seeing this bright child hanging so carelessly off the arm of a silent brother, hooded and cloaked and shrouded in darkness. Matthew seemed blissfully unaware of the incongruity.
I believe we will be, said Jem.
My cousin Anna says the shadow market is tremendous fun, said Matthew happily. Of course you know Anna. She's always tremendous fun herself, and has the best taste in waistcoats in London. I met some very agreeable fairies who invited me, and I thought I would come see.
The fairies Matthew had been dancing with previously whisked past, streaks of light in flower crowns. One fairy boy, lips stained with the juice of a strange fruit, paused and winked at Matthew. He appeared not to resent being deserted in their dance, though appearances were seldom reliable with fairies. Matthew hesitated, casting a wary eye upon Brother Zachariah, and then winked back.
Brother Zachariah felt he had to warn. Your friends may mean mischief. Fairies often do.
Matthew smiled, the lovely expression turning wicked. I mean mischief frequently myself.
That is not exactly what I mean, nor do I intend to insult any downworlders.
There are as many trustworthy downworlders as there are shadow hunters, which means the opposite is also true. It might be wise to remember that not all those at the shadow market look with favour on the Nephilim.
But who can blame them? Said Matthew airily. Stuffy lot. Present company accepted, Uncle Jem. My papa has a warlock friend he talks of frequently. They invented portals together, did you know? I would like to have an intimate downworlder friend too.
Magnus Bane would be a good friend for anyone to have, Brother Zachariah agreed.
It would have seemed disrespect to Magnus, who had been such a good friend to Jem's parapetai, to press the issue with Matthew any further. Perhaps he was being too cautious. Many of the downworlders were sure to be taken with Matthew's ready charm. Will had made it clear his institute was there to help downworlders who sought aid, as surely as it was for mundanes and shadow hunters. Maybe this new generation could grow up in more charity with downworlders than any before them.
Anna is not here tonight, Matthew added. But you are, so all's well. What are we going to do together? Are you looking for something special? I rather thought I might buy Jamie and Luce a book. Any book would do, they love them all.
It made Jem warm to him even more to hear him speak of James and Lucy with such obvious affection.
If we see a suitable book, he said, let us buy it for them. I would rather not buy them a tome of dangerous enchantment.
By the angel, no, said Matthew. Luce would read it for sure. Bit of a daredevil in a quiet way, Lou.
As for me, said Jem, I have a commission from someone else who I hold in high regard. Out of respect for them, I can say nothing more.
I completely understand, said Matthew, looking pleased to be this far in Jem's confidence. I won't ask, but is there anything I can do to help? You can rely on me if you would. We love all the same people, don't we?
Thank you most sincerely for the offer.
There was no way for this child to help him, not in this current search, but his presence made Zachariah feel as if he could borrow some of Matthew's delighted wonder as he looked around the market, and they strolled around taking in its sounds and sights together.
There were stalls selling fairy fruit, though there was also a werewolf outside the stall making dark remarks about being cheated and not making deals with goblin men. There were stalls with red and white striped awnings selling cinder toffee, though Brother Zachariah had doubts about its provenance. Matthew stopped and laughed for sheer joy at a warlock woman with blue skin who was juggling toy unicorns, mermaid shells and small wheels of fire, and he flirted until she told him her name was Katerina. She added that he certainly might not call upon her, but when he smiled, she smiled back. Brother Zachariah imagined people usually did. The shadow market as a whole seemed rather bemused by Matthew. They were accustomed to shadow hunters arriving on the hunt for witnesses or culprits, not demonstrating huge enthusiasm. Matthew applauded when another stall sidled up to him, walking on chicken feet. A fairy woman with dandelion fluff hair peered out among vials of many-coloured lights and liquids.
Hello, pretty, she said,
her voice rasping like bark.
Which one of us are you talking to?
asked Matthew, laughing and leaning his elbow against Brother Zachariah's shoulder. The fairy woman regarded Zachariah with suspicion.
Ooh, a silent brother at our humble market. The Nephilim would consider that we were being honored.
Do you feel honored? Asked Zachariah, shifting his stance slightly to stand protectively in front of Matthew. Oblivious, Matthew sauntered past Zachariah to examine the vials laid out before him. Jolly nice potions, he said, flashing his smile upon the woman.
Did you make them yourself? Good show. That makes you something of an inventor, does it not?
My papa is an inventor.
I am happy to have anyone at the market who has an interest in my wares, said the woman, unbending. I see you have a honey tongue to match your hair. How old are you?
15, Matthew replied promptly. He began to sort among the vials, his rings clinking against the glass and their wood and gold or silver stoppers, chattering about his father and fairy potions he'd read about.
Ah, 15 summers, and by the look of you it has been all summer.
Some would say only a shallow river could flash so bright, said the fairy woman, and Matthew looked up at her, an unguarded child surprised by any hurt dealt him. His smile flickered for an instant. Before Jem could intervene, the smile resumed.
Ah, well, he has nothing, but he looks everything. What more can one desire? Matthew quoted.
Oscar Wilde. Do you know his work? I heard fairies like to steal poets. You should definitely have tried to steal him.
The woman laughed.
Perchance we did. Do you wish to be stolen, honey sweet boy?
I do not think my mamma, the consul, would like that at all, no.
Matthew continued to beam radiantly upon her. The fairy looked discomforted for a moment, then smiled back. Fairies could prick like thorns because it was their very nature, not because they meant harm.
This is a love charm, said the fairy woman,
nodding to a vial filled with a delicately sparkling pink substance.
No use to you, fairest child of the Nephilim. Now this would blind your opponents in battle.
I imagine it would, said Brother Zachariah, studying the vial full of charcoal-coloured sand.
Matthew was transparently pleased to hear about the potions. Zachariah was sure Henry's boys had been regaled with tales of the elements over dinner time and time again.
What's this one?
Matthew asked, pointing to a purple vial.
Oh, another one that would be of no interest to the Nephilim, said the woman dismissively. What need would you have of a potion that would make the one who took it tell you all the truth? You shadow hunters have no secrets amongst each other, I hear. Besides which, you have that mortal sword to prove one of you is telling the truth, though I call that a brutal business.
It is brutal, Matthew agreed vehemently.
The fairy woman looked almost sad.
You come of a brutal people, sweet child.
Not me, said Matthew. I believe in art and beauty.
You might be pitiless one day for all that.
No, never, Matthew insisted. I don't care for shadow hunter customs at all. I like downworlder ways much more.
Ah, you flatter an old woman, said the fairy, waving a hand,
but her face wrinkled up like a pleased apple as she smiled once more.
Now, come, since you are a darling boy, let me show you something very special. What would you say to a vial of distilled stars guaranteeing the one who carried it long life?
Enough, said the voices in Zachariah's head. Shadow hunters do not make bargains for their own lives, said Brother Zachariah, and towed Matthew away by his sleeve.
Matthew flailed and squawked a protest.
The woman's potions were in all likelihood coloured water and sand, said Zachariah. Do not waste your money or make any other bargain with the Fae. You must be careful at the market. They sell heartbreak as well as dreams.
Oh, very well, said Matthew. Oh, look, Uncle Jem! That werewolf is running a bookstall. Werewolves are surprisingly ardent readers, you know.
He dashed over and began to ask artless questions of a lady werewolf in a prim dress, who was soon painting her hair and laughing at his nonsense. Brother Zachariah's attention was suddenly arrested by the warlock he had been searching for.
Wait for me here,
he told Matthew, and went to meet Ragnar Fell by the side of the fire under one of the railway arches. As the fire leaped, it birthed green sparks that matched the clever face of the warlock and lit his snowy white hair, curling around the sterner curl of his horns. Brother Zachariah, he said, nodding. A pleasure. But I wish I had better news for you. Ah, well. Bad news comes like rain and good news like lightning, barely seen before a crash.
A cheerful thought,
said Brother Zachariah, his heart sinking. I went to several sources about the information you asked for, said Ragnar. I have a lead, but I have to tell you, I was warned that this quest might prove fatal, that it has already proved fatal to more than one person. Do you truly want me to follow up on the lead?
I do, said Brother Zachariah. He had hoped for more. When he had met Tessa on the bridge that year, she had seemed concerned as she talked to him. It had been a grey day. The wind had blown her brown hair back from the face that trouble could touch as time could not. Sometimes it seemed like her face was all the heart he had left. He could not do much for her, but he had once promised to spend his life guarding her from the very wind from heaven. He intended to keep his word in that, at least. Ragnar Fell nodded.
I will keep searching.
So will I, said Brother Zachariah.
Ragnar's face changed to a look of deep alarm. Brother Zachariah turned and beheld Matthew, who had wandered back to the fairy woman's stall of potions.
Matthew, Brother Zachariah called, come here.
Matthew nodded and came reluctantly forward, smoothing his waistcoat. The look of alarm on Ragnar's face deepened.
Why is he coming over? Why would you do this to me?
I'd always considered you one of the more sensible shadow hunters, not that this is saying much. Brother Zachariah studied Ragnar. It was unusual to see the warlock rattled, and he was usually very discreet and professional.
I thought you had a long and cherished history of mutual esteem with the Fairchilds, said Brother Zachariah.
Oh, certainly, said Ragnar. And I have a long and cherished history of not getting blown up.
What? Asked Zachariah.
The mystery was explained when Matthew caught sight of Ragnar and beamed.
Oh, hello, Professor Fell. He glanced in Jem's direction. Professor Fell taught me at the academy before I was expelled.
Very expelled.
Jem had been aware that James had been expelled, but he had not known Matthew was too. He had thought Matthew had simply chosen to follow his parabatai, as anyone would if they could.
Is your friend with you?
Asked Ragnar Fell and twitched.
Is Christopher Lightwood upon the premises? Is our market shortly to be engulfed in flames?
No, Matthew said, sounding amused. Christopher is at home.
At home in Idris?
In the Lightwoods' London home, but it is far away.
Not far enough, decided Ragnar Fell. I shall decamp to Paris forthwith.
He nodded at Brother Zachariah, visibly shuddered at Matthew, and turned away. Matthew waved forlornly after him.
Goodbye, Professor Fell, he called.
He looked up at Brother Zachariah. Christopher did not mean to cause any of the accidents, and the large explosion was entirely my fault.
I see, said Brother Zachariah. Brother Zachariah was not sure he did see.
You must know Gideon quite well,
Matthew remarked, his quicksilver mind flashing onto another topic.
I do, said Brother Zachariah. He is the best of good fellows.
Matthew shrugged. If you say so. I like my Uncle Gabriel better. Not as much as Uncle Will, of course.
Will has always been my favourite too, Jem agreed solemnly.
Matthew chewed his lower lip, clearly considering something.
Would you care to accept a wager, Uncle Jem, that I can clear that fire with a foot to spare?
I would not, said Brother Zachariah with conviction.
Matthew, wait. Matthew charged at the flame, sparkling with jade light, and leaped. He twisted in midair. Slim black-clad body like a dagger thrown by an expert hand, and landed on his feet in the shadow of the church spire. After a moment, several members of the shadow market began to clap, Matthew mimed taking off an imaginary hat and bowed with a flourish. His hair was gold even by strange flames, his face bright even in shadow. Brother Zachariah watched him laugh, and foreboding crept into his heart. He experienced sudden fear for Matthew, for all of the shining, beloved children belonging to his dear friends. By the time he was Matthew's age, he and Will had been through fire and burning silver. His generation had suffered so they could bring the next one forth into a better world, but now it occurred to Jem that those children, taught to expect love and walk fearless through shadows, would be shocked and betrayed by disaster. Some of them might be broken. Pray disaster never came.
Fairchild Residence, London, 1901.
Matthew was still thinking about his visit to the shadow market the next day. In some ways it had been rotten luck, coming upon Uncle Jem like that.
though he had been glad for the chance to become better acquainted. Perhaps Uncle Jem would think Jamie had not made a bad choice in his parapet eye. He rose early to help Cook with the baking. Cook had arthritis, and Matthew's mamma had asked if she was not getting along in years and wishing to retire. But Cook did not wish to retire, and nobody had to know if Matthew lent a hand in the early morning. Besides, Matthew liked to see his papa and mamma and even Charles eating breakfast he had prepared. His mother always worked too hard. Lines of worry etched between her brows and around her mouth that never disappeared, even if Matthew managed to make her laugh. She liked scones with cranberries baked in, so he tried to make them for her whenever he might. Matthew could not do anything else for her. He was not a strong support for her like Charles. "Charles Buford is so serious-minded and reliable," one of his mother's friends had said when they were taking tea together in Idris. She had bit into one of Mother's special scones. "And Matthew, well, he is charming." That morning at breakfast, Charles Buford reached for the plate of Mama's scones. Matthew gave him a smile and a very decided shake of the head, moving the plate to his mother's elbow. Charles Buford grimaced in Matthew's direction. Charlotte gave him a distracted smile, then returned to complimenting the tablecloth. She was in a brown study. Matthew wished he could say that was an unusual occurrence these days, but it was not. For months there had been something wrong in the atmosphere of home, with not only his mother but his father and even Charles Buford looking abstracted and occasionally snapping at Matthew. Sometimes Matthew dreaded the thought of what he might be told, that it was time he knew the truth, that his mother was going away forever. Sometimes Matthew thought if he only knew, he could bear it. "My dear," said Papa, "are you feeling well?"
"Perfectly, Henry," said Mama.
Matthew loved his father beyond reason, but he knew him. He was well aware that there were times when the entire family could have had their heads replaced with parakeet heads, and Papa would simply tell the parakeet heads all about his latest experiment. Now his father was watching his mother with worried eyes. Matthew could picture him saying, "Please, Charlotte, do not leave me." His heart lurched in his chest. Matthew folded his napkin three times over in his hands and said, "Could somebody tell me?" Then the door opened, and Gideon Lightwood came in. Mr. Lightwood. Matthew refused to think or speak of him as Uncle Gideon any longer.
"What are you doing here?" said Matthew.
"Sir," Mama said sharply.
"Really, Matthew, call him sir."
"What are you doing here?" said Matthew.
"Sir."
Mr. Gideon Lightwood had the cheek to give Matthew a brief smile before he walked over and put his hand upon Mama's shoulder, in front of Matthew's papa.
"Always a pleasure to see you, sir," said Charles Buford, that wretch. "May I serve you some kippers?"
No, not at all. I already ate my breakfast," said Mr. Lightwood. "I merely thought to accompany Charlotte through the portal to Idris."
Mama smiled properly for Mr. Lightwood, as she had not for Matthew.
"That is very kind, Gideon, though not necessary."
"It is most necessary," said Mr. Lightwood.
"A lady should always have the escort of a gentleman."
His voice was teasing. Matthew usually waited until after breakfast to take his father down in his chair to his laboratory, but he could not bear this.
"I must see James at once upon urgent business," he declared, bolting upright.
He slammed the door of the breakfast parlour shut behind him, but not before he heard Ma apologise for him, and Mr. Lightwood say,
"Oh, that's all right. The age he is at is a difficult one. Believe me, I remember it well."
Before Matthew left, he ran up to his bedroom mirror to adjust his hair, cuffs, and smooth his green waistcoat. He stared at his face in the glass, framed with gold. A pretty face, but not a clever one like everyone else in the family's. He remembered the fairy woman saying,
"Some would say only a shallow river could flash so bright."
He tilted his head as he looked into the glass. Many people thought his eyes were as dark as his mamma's, but they were not. They were such a dark green that they fooled people, except when light struck the dark a certain way and the depth flashed emerald. Like the rest of him, his eyes were a trick. He drew the vial of truth potion from his sleeve. Uncle Jem had not seen him buy it. Even if Uncle Jem suspected he had it, Uncle Jem would not peach on him. When Uncle Jem said something, you believed it. He was that kind of person. Matthew had refrained from ever mentioning his thoughts about Gideon to James, because Matthew was the soul of discretion, and Jamie had an awful temper on him sometimes. Last summer, a perfectly amiable shadow hunter named Augustus Pouncey had come to the London Institute on his tour abroad, and Matthew had left Pouncey in James's sole company for less than half an hour.
When Matthew returned, he found Jamie had thrown Pouncey into the Thames. All James would say was that Pouncey insulted him. It was quite a feat, since Pouncey was a shadow hunter fully grown and Jamie was 14 at the time. Still, however impressive, it could not be considered good manners. Neither James nor Uncle Jem would buy potions like a sneak, or consider administering them. Only, what harm would it do to finally learn the truth? Matthew had considered adding a drop from the vial to breakfast this morning. Then, father and mother would have to tell them all what was happening. Now that Mr. Gideon Lightwood had started popping in of a morning, he wished he had. Matthew shook his head at his reflection and determined to banish melancholy and dull care.
"Do I look dapper?"
he asked Mr. Oscar Wilde.
"Do I look dashing and debonair?"
Mr. Oscar Wilde gave him a lick on the nose, because Mr. Oscar Wilde was a puppy Jamie had given Matthew on his birthday. Matthew took this as approval. Matthew pointed to his reflection.
"You may be a waste of space in a waistcoat," he told Matthew Fairchild, "but at least your waistcoat is fantastic."
He checked his pocket watch, then tucked pocket watch and vial into his waistcoat. Matthew could not linger. He had an important appointment at a most exclusive club. First, Matthew had to breeze into the London Institute to collect a parcel known as James Herondale. He had a shrewd idea of where James was likely to be, so he told Oscar to stay and guard a lamppost. Oscar obeyed. He was very well behaved for a puppy, and people said Matthew must have trained him well, but Matthew only loved him. Matthew threw a grappling hook up to the library window, climbed up while being careful of his trousers, and tapped on the glass. James was in the window seat, his black head bent over. What a surprise! A book. He looked up at the tap and smiled. James had never really needed Matthew. James had been so shy, and Matthew had wanted to take care of him, but now that James was growing into his angular features and accustomed to having the certain company of three good friends, he was far more collected during social gatherings. Even when Jamie was shy, he never seemed to doubt or wish to alter himself. He never looked to Matthew for rescue. There was a quiet, deep certainty to James that Matthew wished he had himself. From the start, there was something between them which was more equal than between him and Thomas, or him and Christopher. Something that made Matthew want to prove himself to James. He was not sure he ever truly had. James never looked relieved to see Matthew or expectant. He only looked pleased. He opened the window and Matthew crawled in, upsetting both James and the book from the window seat.
"Hello, Matthew," said James from the floor in slightly sardonic tones.
"Hello, Matthew," chimed Lucy from her writing desk. She was a picture of dainty disarray, clearly in the throes of composition. Her light brown curls were half pulled out of a blue ribbon, one shoe dangling precariously of her stocking toes. Uncle Will frequently gave dramatic readings from the book he was writing on demon pox, which were very droll. Lucy did not show her writing around. Matthew had often considered asking her if she might read him a page, but he could think of no reason why Lucy would make a special exception for him.
"Bless you, my Herondales," said Matthew grandly, scrambling up from the floor and making Lucy his bow. "I come upon an urgent errand. Tell me, and be honest, what do you think of my waistcoat?"
Lucy dimpled.
"Devastating."
"What Lucy said," James agreed peacefully.
"Not fantastic?" Matthew asked. "Not positively stunning?"
"I suppose I am stunned," said James. "But am I positively stunned?"
"Refrain from playing cruel word games with your one and only parabatai," Matthew requested. "Attend to your own attire, if you please. Heave that beastly book away. The Misters Lightwood await us. We must hook it."
"Can't I go as I am?" asked James. He looked up at Matthew with wide gold eyes from his position on the floor. His pitch-black hair was askew, his linen shirt rumpled, and he was not even wearing a waistcoat. Matthew nobly repressed a convulsive shudder.
"Surely you jest," said Matthew. "I know you only say these things to hurt me. Off with you. Brush your hair."
"The hairbrush mutiny is coming," warned James, making for the door.
"Come back victorious or on the hairbrushes of your soldiers," Matthew called after him.
When Jamie was flown, Matthew turned to Lucy, who was scribbling intently, but who looked up as if sensing his glance and smiled. Matthew wondered how it would be to be self-sufficient and welcoming with it, like a house with sturdy walls and a beacon light always burning.
"Should I brush my hair?" Lucy teased.
"You are, as always, perfect," said Matthew.
He wished he could fix the ribbon in her hair, but that would be taking a liberty. "Do you wish to attend our secret club meeting?" asked Matthew.
"I cannot. I'm doing lessons with my mother. Mam and I are teaching ourselves Farsi," said Lucy. "I should be able to speak the languages my parrot speaks, shouldn't I?"
James had recently started calling his mother and father Mam and Da, rather than Mama and Papa, since it sounded more grown up. Lucy had instantly copied him in this matter. Matthew rather liked hearing their Welsh lilts in their voices when they called their parents, their voices soft as songs and always loving.
"Of a certainty," said Matthew, coughing and making a private resolution to return to his Welsh lessons.
There had been no question of Lucy attending Shadowhunter Academy. She had never demonstrated any abilities like James's, but the world was cruel enough to women, who were even suspected of being the least bit different.
"Lucy Herondale is a sweet child, but with her disadvantages, who would marry her?"
Lavinia Whitelaw had asked Matthew's mamma once over tea.
"I would be happy if either of my sons wished to," said Charlotte in her most consul-like manner.
Matthew thought James was very lucky to have Lucy. He had always wanted a little sister. Not that he wanted Lucy to be his sister.
"Are you writing your book, Luce?"
Matthew asked, tentatively.
"No, a letter to Cordelia," Lucy answered, shattering Matthew's fragile plot.
"I hope Cordelia will come and visit very soon," added Lucy with earnest eagerness.
"You will like her so much, Matthew, I know you will."
"Hmm," said Matthew. Matthew had his doubts about Cordelia Carstairs. Lucy was going to be parapetai with Cordelia one day, when the Clave decided they were grown-up ladies who knew their own minds. Lucy and James were acquainted with Cordelia from childhood adventures that Matthew had not been a part of, and which Matthew felt a bit jealous about. Cordelia must have some redeeming qualities, or Lucy would not want her for a parapetai. But she was Alistair Loathly Worm Carstairs' sister, so it would be strange if she was entirely amiable.
"She sent me a picture of herself in her latest. This is Cordelia," Lucy continued in tones of pride. "Is she not the prettiest girl you ever saw?"
"Oh, well," said Matthew.
"Perhaps."
He was privately surprised by the picture. He would have thought Alistair's sister might share Alistair's unpleasant look, as if he were eating lemons he looked down upon. She did not. Instead, Matthew was reminded of a line in a poem James had read to him once about unrequited love. That child of shower and gleam described the vivid face laughing up at him from the frame exactly.
"All I know is," Matthew continued, "you have every other girl in London beat to flinders."
Lucy coloured faint pink.
"You are always teasing, Matthew."
"Did Cordelia ask you to be parapetai?" Matthew said casually. "Or did you ask her?"
Lucy and Cordelia had wanted to be made parapetai before they were parted, but they were warned that sometimes you regret a bond made young, and sometimes one partner or another would change their mind. Particularly, Lawrence Ashdown had remarked, since ladies could be so flighty. Lucy was not flighty. She and Cordelia wrote to each other faithfully every day. Lucy had even told Matthew she was writing a long story to keep Cordelia amused, since Cordelia was always so far away. Matthew did not really wonder why someone like Lucy found it difficult to take someone like Matthew seriously.
"I asked her, of course," Lucy said promptly. "I did not wish to miss my chance."
Matthew nodded, confirmed in his new belief that Cordelia Carstairs must be something special. He was sure that if he had not asked James to be parapetai, James would never have thought of asking him. James returned to the room.
"Satisfied?" he asked.
"That is a strong word, Jamie," said Matthew. "Consider my waistcoat wrath somewhat appeased."
James still had his book tucked under his arm, but Matthew knew better than to fight doomed battles. He told Matthew about the book as they walked the London streets. Matthew enjoyed the modern and humorous, such as the works of Oscar Wilde or the music of Gilbert and Sullivan, but Greek history was not so bad when it was Jamie telling him. Matthew had taken to reading more and more literature of old stories of doomed love and noble battles. He could not find himself in them, but he saw James in them, and that was enough. They walked unglamoured, as Matthew always insisted they would in his quest to make Jamie feel less self-conscious after the disasters of the academy. A young lady, arrested by Jamie's bone structure, stopped in the path of an omnibus. Matthew seized her waist and whirled her to safety, giving her a tip of his hat and a smile. Jamie seemed to miss the whole incident entirely, fiddling with something beneath his shirt cuff. There were crowds protesting the mundane war outside the Houses of Parliament.
The Boer War? Asked Matthew. That cannot be right. The Boer War, said James. Honestly, Matthew.
That makes more sense, Matthew admitted.
A lady in a shapeless hat caught hold of Matthew's sleeve.
May I be of assistance, madam? Asked Matthew.
They are committing unspeakable atrocities, said the lady.
They have children penned up in camps. Think of the children.
James fastened his hand on Matthew's sleeve and towed him away, with an apologetic hat tip to the lady. Matthew looked over his shoulder.
I do hope affairs go right for the children, he called.
James appeared pensive as they went. Matthew knew James wished shadow hunters could solve problems like a mundane war, though Matthew felt they were rather overstretched as it was with all the demons. In order to cheer Jamie up, he stole his hat. Jamie burst into startled laughter and pursued Matthew, both of them racing and jumping high enough to amaze the mundanes under the shadow of St. Stephen's Tower. Matthew's puppy lost his head, forgot his training, and dashed under their feet, yapping with the sheer joy of being alive. Their rushing footsteps outpaced the steady tick of the great clock, under which was written in James's beloved Latin, O Lord, keep safe our Queen Victoria the First, and their laughter mingled with the gleeful chime and roar of the bells. Later, Matthew would look back and remember it as his last happy day.
Do I sleep or do I dream or are these visions I see? Demanded Matthew. Why are Aunt Sophie and both of Thomas's sisters taking tea in the same establishment as our private and exclusive clubroom?
They followed me, said Thomas in beleaguered tones.
Mama was understanding, or they would have followed us directly into the clubroom.
Aunt Sophie was a good sport, but that did not make Matthew feel any less uneasy about the advent of Thomas's sisters. They were not kindred spirits, and they were liable to consider all the doings of their little brother both their business and very silly. Matthew loved their clubroom and would brook no interference. He had chosen the materials for the curtains himself, made certain that James put the works of Oscar Wilde in their extensive book collection, and reinforced the corner that was Christopher's laboratory with steel sheets on the walls. Which led Matthew to another grievance. He regarded Christopher with a steely gaze.
Did you sleep in those clothes, Christopher? I know Aunt Cecily, Uncle Gabriel and Cousin Anna would never let you inflict these horrors on the populace. What are those peculiar lavender stains upon your shirt front? Did you set your sleeves on fire?
Christopher regarded his sleeves as if he'd never beheld them before.
A bit, he said guiltily. Ah, well, said Matthew. At least the purple stains match your eyes.
Christopher blinked said eyes, the improbable shade of violets in summer, and smiled his slow blossoming smile. He clearly did not understand Matthew's objections, but was vaguely pleased they'd been overcome. It was not like with James, who actually presented a very fine appearance to the world. Christopher was incorrigible. He could rumple leather boots. He could certainly set fire to anything. Matthew had not meant for Christopher to be asked to leave Shadowhunter Academy, but as it emerged, they did not let you remain in school if you blew up any portion of it. Besides which, Professor Fell had threatened to leave the Academy forever if Christopher remained. Thomas had stayed out the full year, but found no reason to return with his friends gone, and Alistair, God help us, Carstairs, graduated. So, by luck, the closeness between their families and an irresponsible attitude to flammable materials, more often than not, all Matthew's closest friends would live close together in London. They trained together at the London Institute and took lessons together in various schoolrooms, and Lavinia Whitelaw had referred to them as
that notorious bunch of hooligan boys.
Matthew and James had called themselves shadow hooligans for some time after that remark. They had decided it was long past time to have a room of their own, inviolate from parents, however well-meaning, and preserved from siblings. Though Cousin Anna and Luce were always welcome, due to being kindred spirits. So, they had rented a room from the proprietor of the Devil Tavern, who owed the Herondale some sort of favour. They paid a monthly fee, and had it all to themselves. Matthew regarded their room with deep satisfaction. It looked very well, he thought, and best, with all four of them sitting in it. In honour of Ben Jonson's Apollo Club, which had once held its meetings in this very tavern, a bust of the god hung over the fireplace with words cut into the marble beneath the head and shoulders. Welcome all who lead or follow to the oracle of Apollo. All his answers are divine. Truth itself doth flow in wine. There was, of course, a window seat for Jamie,
and Jamie was already installed with his book upon his lap. Christopher sat in his laboratory, adding an alarming orange liquid to a bubbling purple liquid, his face a picture of contentment. Thomas was seated cross-legged upon the sofa and earnestly practicing his blade work. Thomas was very conscientious and worried about not being a good enough shadow hunter due to being undersized. Thomas's sisters were a good deal taller than he was. So was everybody. Aunt Sophie, Tom's mama, said that Thomas would shoot up someday. She said she believed one of her grandpapas had been a blacksmith and a giant of a man, small as a pea until he was 17. Aunt Sophie was a kind lady, very beautiful and most interesting with her tales of mundanes. Matthew did not know how Mr. Gideon Lightwood could live with himself. Matthew turned over the vial of truth potion in his waistcoat. Friends, now we are all gathered together, shall we share secrets? Jamie fiddled with his shirt cuff again, which he always did upon certain occasions and pretended not to hear. Matthew suspected he had a secret love. He sometimes wondered whether James would have confided in him if he had been a different sort of person, more serious-minded and dependable. Matthew laughed. Come now, any deadly hatreds you harbour in your bosom? Any ladies of your heart? Thomas flushed a deep red and dropped his knife. No. Oscar bounded over to fetch the knife for Thomas, and Thomas stroked his floppy ears. Matthew sauntered closer to the laboratory corner, though he knew it was rash. Is there anyone who has caught your eye? He asked Christopher. Christopher eyed Matthew with alarm. Matthew sighed and prepared himself to explain further. Is there a lady you find yourself thinking of more than other ladies? Asked Matthew. Or a fellow, he added tentatively. Christopher's face cleared. Yes, I see. Well, yes, there is a lady. Christopher, Matthew exclaimed, delighted. You sly dog, do I know her? No, I cannot think so, said Christopher. She is a mundane. Christopher, you dark horse, said Matthew. What is her name? Mrs. A married lady, Matthew said, overwhelmed. No. I beg your pardon. Please go on. Mrs. Mary Curie, said Christopher. I believe her to be one of the preeminent scientists of the age. If you read her papers, Matthew, I believe you'd be most interested. Have you ever met this lady? Said Matthew in dangerous tones. No, said Christopher, heedless of danger, as he often was around irate teachers and naked flames. Christopher had the audacity to look surprised when Matthew began to belabour him mightily about the head and face. What's the test tubes? Cried Thomas. There is a hole in the floor at the academy that Professor Fell calls the Christopher Lightwood Chasm. I suppose I hate some people, offered James. Augustus Pouncebe, Lavinia Whitelaw, Alistair Carstairs. Matthew regarded his very own parapet eye with deep approval. This is why we are chosen warrior partners, because we share such a perfect bond of sympathy. Come to me, Jamie, that we might share a manly embrace. He made incursions upon Jamie's person. James thwacked him over the head with his book. It was a large book. Betrayed, said Matthew, writhing prone upon the floor. Is that why you insist on carrying about enormous tomes everywhere you go, that you might visit violence upon innocent persons? Done to death by my best friend, my heart's brother, my own dear parapet eye. He snagged James around the waist and brought him crashing to the floor for the second time that day. James hit Matthew with the book again, then subsided, leaning his shoulder against Matthew's. They were both thoroughly rumpled, but Matthew did not mind being rumpled for a good cause. Matthew jostled James, very thankful that he'd brought up Alistair and provided Matthew an opening to tell his secret. Alistair is not so bad, said Thomas unexpectedly from the sofa. They all looked at him, and Tom curled up like an earwig under their scrutiny, but persisted. I know what Alistair did to James was wrong, Thomas said. Alistair knows that very well too. That's why he was prickly whenever it was mentioned. How is that different from his usual ghastly demeanour? Matthew demanded. Besides him being particularly noxious the day everybody else's parents came to the academy. He paused to consider how to tell them, but that gave Thomas a chance to speak. Yes, exactly. Everybody's papa came but Alistair's, Thomas said quietly. Alistair was jealous. Mr. Herondale came rushing to Jamie's defence and nobody came for Alistair. Can one truly blame the man? Asked Matthew.
Had I such an insufferable toad of a son, and were he blessedly to be sent away to school, I'm not sure I could bring myself to blast my sight with his visage until the accursed holidays carried him back to me again. Thomas did not